Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about mothers in D&D, mothers in mythology, mothers as monsters, and the mothers who have inspired us. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin, everyone, I'll remind you, as always, that at the very end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat with Dan and I that is hosted on our private Discord server. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that set up and rolling, because at about 10 after 2 Eastern time, we'll be over there hosting the after-party chat, and we'd love to see you.
We definitely would. And also, happy Mother's Day to everybody today, of course, May 12th, while we're doing this. And if you're with us live, love to see you here. So I thought today, Paul, this would be a good opportunity to talk about mothers. And then, you know, I was researching and I was like, oh, this could go in a whole bunch of different interesting directions.
Definitely could. I'd love to kick us off, Dan, actually, with just a personal anecdote, and we'll see if this goes anywhere or not. But I'm going to, apologies for being a bit Freudian, but I'm going to talk about my mother. Yeah, that's not where you thought this was going, was it?
But I did not.
You know, anecdotally, I was thinking about, you know, have I gamed with my mother? And of course, the answer is very much so. In fact, she's been instrumental in my early formative gamer years. I think I probably told the story on the channel before about how the very way I discovered D&D is that my dad bought my mom the Moldvay basic box set because it had a picture of a dragon on the front, and he thought, she's into that kind of stuff. And he gave it to her, and she had no idea what to do with it and what to make of it, so she stuck it in her closet, and it sat there for a year or two until my brother discovered it. And then we thought that found this amazing treasure in the back of mom's closet, and we started digging in and playing it. And that's how I started playing D&D. So thanks for that one, Mom. So she did, I don't think that was really quite her fault, apart from being into dragons. And then of course, the first gaming convention I ever went to, I was probably like, I don't know, 11 years old, 10, 11 years old. My mother was working at Columbia University. And the students there hosted a convention, and I was super into D&D by that point. And so mom said, I'll bring you. And she brought me. And bless her, and bless everyone who was stuck playing with the 11-year-old at the table. Because she went along with me from game to game, and we played. I think I remember rankling at it at the time. I'm like, I don't need mom here. I can do this. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm sure everyone else at the table appreciated that mom was there.
And she was playing in those games? Great.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, she played in those games. So yeah, some of my earliest D&D playing actually was with mom. Yeah. She never really got into it, never really understood it, was always just very supportive and, you know, wanted to help me with right? She was super into fantasy literature for sure, right? So like dad wasn't wrong about the dragons on the front of the box being something that she's interested in. So I remember early on when I started reading fantasy literature, she introduced me to Ari Salvatore and, I'm forgetting the author's name who wrote The Dragon Riders of Pern, Anne McCaffrey.
There you go.
So we read a lot of those books together. So mom was definitely instrumental in getting me into the genre, shall we say. And then, you know, very supportive mother in this. And then, you know, there's routinely throughout the years as I got super into it, like really allowed me to do some crazy things. First time I ever went to a LARP, I was 15 or 16. I was just fresh back from my first trip to Gen Con. And which also amazed that I got to go to that at that young age. Flew out to Wisconsin to go to Gen Con, came home with a written pamphlet about LARPing. And like, because this is in a time when internet isn't quite what internet wasn't then what it is today. So my only way of discovering about the concept of LARPing was a written, printed pamphlet that I came home with. I said, I think it was in Connecticut, and I had a phone number on it. And so I called the phone number on the pamphlet to say, I want to do this. How do I do it? I'm 16, right? I have no way. And they were very helpful. And the person I was talking to was like, great, we have a group from Brooklyn that goes. Let me get you in touch with them. I got another phone number of some random wow. people in Brooklyn. And I called them up and they're like, yeah, we're going up on such and such date. If you want to come, happy to give you a ride to and from. These are just like young 20 somethings in Brooklyn. They showed up in their van, which, you know, reeked of pot smoke. And mom put me in the van and sent me off for a weekend in Connecticut with a bunch of strangers to go hit each other with padded sticks. Thanks, Mom. I have no idea why you did that. But nothing bad happened. It was great. I had a great time. So
those are yeah.
I was going to
throw that up here because when Paul, you said that your mother got you into Anne McCaffrey and R.A. Salvatore, I noticed this message in the chat that came over and said, and I still want to meet Bob.
Yeah.
Marianne, good to see you this today. Happy Mother's Day.
Failed. I don't know why that's never happened, although honestly, I haven't seen Bob myself in a number of years at this point, but should... reach out to him. Get him to an event that I can invite Mom around to. How about you, Dan? Have you ever played D&D with your mother?
I think that your experience is like super nice and super special, Paul. I assume that's pretty rare. And if any of our viewers want to hop in the chat and tell us yes or no if they have played D&D with their mothers, I certainly have not. Go ahead.
I would go out on a limb and say it's probably rare for our generation, Dan, for those of us who came to D&D when it was brand new. But I bet you that a fair number of current folks, of current young people who are into D&D are probably have been introduced to it by their parents. Because I see it a lot at game conventions, right? I've been to plenty of game conventions where people are there with their kids and they're like, I'm a lifelong gamer and my kid's just now old enough to really understand it and they're going to play. Right. And I feel like I see a lot of that kind of stuff of like, you know, how to introduce your young kids to D&D. It's definitely
that is really, really fascinating. And the kids nowadays that are close to their parents, that's great. That's you youngsters and Paul, I kind of include you too. You youngsters that like your parents. That is I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. My folks, you know, were very supportive, weren't into fantasy literature or things like that. And so I'll say that my folks, such as my mother, were kind of middle ground, kind of, you know, trying to keep an open mind and trying to be supportive. This was, you know, what we now call the era of the satanic panic. So you're getting, mm-hmm. you know, they're getting information on both sides about this. And obviously, I'm, you know, doing well in school. It's not like I'm, you know, turning into a troubled kid at the time that I'm getting into D&D. But they were, you know, I had friends that their mothers had actually banned D&D in the household things that they'd heard about it. And, you know, and so in certain occasions, I was the lucky recipient of the books that they had to get rid of, frankly. And I will say that my mother did actually provide the probably the single best gift that I ever got, and that was I had a copy of the Holmes Basic set at a time when dice had run out, and so my original basic set of D&D didn't have any dice in it, had the, as we've said a number of times, had the cardboard chits that you had to cut out and put in little Dixie cups. And so as I was developing dungeons as the DM, I was shake, 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 pull out, that is a 19, shake, 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 here's my D8 cup, pull out a thing, you know, painstaking process to do that for months. And at some point, it wasn't Christmas, it wasn't my birthday. At some point, my mom walks in the room I remember this so vividly, in the living room, and I'm doing this, and she goes, hey, maybe this would help. And she just hands me my set of first dice. And my first set of polyhedral lights. And she had gone out specifically for this, not any kind of event, not a celebration, and just said, it looks like this would be really great for you. And I was like, oh my God, they exist. It's in their actual things. They're in my hands. This is amazing. And I was so thrilled. And it was, you know, it was a D20 that was, you know, 0 through 9 twice with different coloring on it that it came with. And I thought that was just the best thing. And it made my experience of playing D&D totally different right off the bat from that. So I will say that my mom, you know, worked as a school nurse, and she is still pleasantly surprised. Again, satanic panic type stuff. She's still pleasantly surprised that D&D gets played in schools. So to this day, she will tell me about that. She goes, you won't believe this, but there's a D&D club at our school that just started. and she's still pleasantly surprised about it today, which is great.
Yeah, that's great. I'm sure those original set of dice that she gave you two are the like ancient plastic about the consistency of a firm cheese.
Yes, they got worn down really fast, but they were great.
You still have them?
I think I have one of them. I think a bunch of them disappeared under radiators and things like that. I think I have one D20 that's pretty well round.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I can't say that you know, growing up, I can't say that saw many moms at the game table like willing to like sit down and play. Supportive mothers like that, of supportive parents in general, who are like, yeah, I don't understand this weird thing you're into, but you seem to like it, so have fun. It must be very strange. It must be a strange experience to have your kid discover this new form of entertainment that is just completely foreign to you. Like, yeah, they seem to like it, so great. Have fun. I don't know.
And it makes them
read a lot. It makes them do a bunch of math. I guess can't be bad, right?
If they look at light, or, you know, and then the negative side is like it's got, you know, some tonality of, you know, the occult or heavy metal type stuff. And that can be possibly off-putting or of concern. I can totally see that. I will say that, you know, like my mom, you know, accepted that kind of thing. And I will say, like, in contrast, as an interesting contrast to your getting a pamphlet about a gaming session, when I was around the same age, I came home with a pamphlet about a D&D summer camp. And that was actually very poorly accepted by contrast to the desire that I go to a sports camp. And I did play 4 sports a year growing up, and that was kind of what we did in our family generally. And it was actually poorly accepted that I might possibly think about doing that instead of a sports camp in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly that, right? Of I was the type of kid, I think, that my parents were always very excited if there was anything I wanted to do that was a little more active, right? That maybe got me outside or maybe move around. So yeah, definitely downside to D&D, seems to sit still, seems to sit on the couch a lot, right? Not the best. Let me spin this in another direction, because we're talking about mothers and D&D, and we're talking about our own parents, right? And how they receive D&D. What about actually, like, at the table, not necessarily real mothers, but have you ever seen people role play a mother or had to role play a mother yourself as DM?
Oh, well, that's interesting. So I think that's a really interesting question. And partly that when we started to dig into this, realizing that, like, at least in classic D&D, I guess, content, like playing like that, like between player characters possibly, is incredibly rare, as it seems very rare. And, you know, you and I have both seen, and we ourselves have played player characters that were brothers. And we've had relationships like brothers or sisters or romantic partners or things like that. But having mother and child characters at the table, I don't think I've ever seen that. And now I guess I want to see that because I think it would be novel, at least for me. Have you seen that in other places?
Well, the one thing that I can think of is one of the Fearful End scenarios that I'm looking to publish sometime, hopefully soon. It's called Mazes and Monsters, and it's about the Satanic Panic. And it's about a group of missing kids, missing college-age kids, and people investigating that. And one of the characters is a mother, and very much a highly overprotective mother, right? And so she actually instigates some of the action very early on in the game, where she's come to the college to demand, like, my son missed his weekly call. Why? Where is he? And I went to his dorm room, and I knocked on the dorm, and there's no one's answering. Where is my son? What have you people done? Right? And the funny thing is, this character... she plays into certain stereotypes of the time and the period, right? She's very very much kind of based on maybe say Fran Drescher from The Nanny, or I'm trying to think of the show. There's a newer show set in the 80s with a mother that is sometimes referred to as the Smother. I'm trying to remember what the heck the name of that show is.
I don't know what anyway. The Goldbergs or something?
The Goldbergs. That's the show. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Great.
Right. So that's the kind of character that she's written as, right? This very overbearing, or a very a helicopter mom. Really, she's a helicopter mom.
Very. Okay.
And yeah, that's what we would call her today. And the funny thing is, I was always a little worried, because I'm like, oh, this character's a little strange, and is maybe the type of personality that most people at the table like wouldn't want to spend a lot of time with, but routinely she is the character who people play to the hilt the most. I will say often the person choosing that character is very excited to have that character, and they just dive in, right? Because I guess because there's so many lovely cliches to easily dig into with that kind of character, and they just become very single-minded, which is delightful, of course, in a horror game, because the character is very willing to do some very stupid things, you know, just for the sake of her baby, right?
Yeah. I remember the time that I played that scenario that totally happened, and it was great, and it was fresh, and it was stuff that meant, you know, I guess some of us that do D&D a lot may not think to dig into, it came off super interesting. Yeah, it's a great scenario.
So that's the major case of that I can think of. And then I was sharing with you earlier, we were talking about the TV show Community. There's an episode kind of late in the series. That's the second D&D episode, the one that you can still see on streaming services, there are two characters in the show, or there's a character in the show who has a son who is kind of an estranged son. And the son is very much into D&D, and so the group decides we're going to run a D&D game to try and, you know, heal the gap here between father and son. And one of the ways we're going to do this, we're going to make them role play characters who are father and son, and have all these themes of father and son reuniting or whatnot and working together. And the son sees right through it. And then like the first 5 minutes of the show, as they're trying to hand out the character sheets, he says, oh, that's boring, let's do this. And he shuffles the characters and hands them out. And so you get some very funny father-son role play between two characters who are nothing to do with father and son, not those characters at all. As well as some funny role play between the characters who are father and son and actually don't have the best relationship with each other, right? So it's a nice little bit of dynamic there. And it makes me, frankly, as I think about that, I'm like, that sounds fun. Like, why not play a parent and child? That sounds great. I bet it comes up in Fiasco now that I think about it, right? I'm trying to think
of Fiasco
that there's been a parent-child relationship. I think I have played that. Actually, I think I did play in a Fiasco game where I was someone's son. Nice. Someone at the table, obviously not someone. I think, you know. So someone else at the table is playing my mom in that game.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think that I feel like if you go back to the classic days of D&D, like the 70s and 80s, I can imagine this being a rare relationship to play. And, you know, similar to when you were 11-ish, Paul, and you had mixed emotions about having your mom with you at the time. You know, on the one hand at the time, there's a consensus that the game was for teenage boys, and yet... Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, there was a thought that this gaming form would clearly be more attractive to women as compared to the prior wargaming hobby that it spawned out of. Oh, here's a version that's clearly going to be for women, but a lot of people consider the consensus of the time to be for teenage boys. And for a lot of teenage boys of the, of that generation, this is a moment when you're trying to break away from your parents and find some kind of independence in the world and practice playing roles that aren't under the umbrella of your parents. So for players like that, I can see bringing a whole lot of motherhood themes into the game might not be exactly what they want at that moment in their life. Right. So I kind of see why that wasn't done a whole heck of a lot in my experience. And so maybe now it's a more interesting thing, a broader thing that we are smart enough to explore nowadays.
Yeah, and it probably, I mean, as I think of games where it fits, I feel like it's probably more likely to come up in a story game or a horror game or something that's not like fantasy adventure, right? Fantasy adventure seems like an odd choice for a mother-child relationship to exist within a party of adventurers. It seems unusual. Although, I mean, that very nature of it being unusual now is drawing to me. And I'm like, that's why I want to role play it.
Yes, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
I want that in my game. That's hilarious.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's start getting on that there.
So let's talk a little bit about where mothers appear predominantly in like mythology or legend, because that is a really important thematic string that gets plucked a lot. And look, you know, fair warning. Mythology legends sometimes have problems of being tangled up in issues of patriarchy and issues of literature that was entirely all written by men all the time, making observations about womanhood and motherhood that might have been, biased or just flat out freaking stupid. but nonetheless, there's some interesting tidbits there. And of course, a place that you could start, critiquing is that a lot of roles for women commonly fall into this, triptych of maiden, wife, and crone. And in particular, the crone role gets, thrown up a lot in classic mythology or legends or things like that. And so one place that you commonly see happen is a mother that's maybe driven or, maybe even a little bit, has goals in the world that she's going to push forward through her children. That might be the hero in a piece of literature or might be the anti-hero in a piece of literature. And a lot of times the mothers in those situations are some kind of witch figure. And obviously if the men folk have, physical stature to them, then kind of an obvious counterpoint is to give the women some kind of like magical powers or supernatural powers as the way that they get, power in the world. So for example, probably the first piece of fantasy literature that I had my hands on was my mom got, and she did not read a lot of fantasy literature. This would be like the only thing I could think of actually was T.H. White's Once and Future King. And she might have had it maybe for like a college course at the time or something like that. And so I picked it up and I think I probably read it like around age 10. And that actually wound up setting a cycle for me where I reread the Once and Future King every 10 years when I turned some multiple of 10 age. So I read it 10, 20, 30. And interestingly, I discover some kind of new texture to it every single time I read it. There was all kinds of stuff that I couldn't grok what they were talking about when I was 10. Then when I was 20 or 30, it was like, oh, crap, they're talking about kind of stuff in my life a lot. And the middle, the whole, of the four parts of the Once and Future King, the second part is entirely devoted to Queen Morgause and her four sons that are all Knights of the Round Table. And so... reminding myself here. So Queen Morgause has four children, Gareth, Agravain, Gaheris, and Mordred. And they're all Knights of the Round Table. And three of them are she mothered by King Lot. And Mordred, of course, she actually mothered by King Arthur himself. And in at least in Once and Future King, she is a really domineering. She wants, you know, power in the world. She's intentionally, you know, mothered Mordred, who ultimately turns out to be the demise of King Arthur himself. And the that second book of Once and Future King is really harrowing, really harrowing. That the ways that she fundamentally is, you know, making use of her sons, and in some ways really tormenting them for her own benefit, as they they try everything in their power to get her to love them, and she's focused on other more worldly pursuits, is really kind of terrifying. And it's not crazy. It's not crazy unworldly stuff. It's like sufficiently intimate and it's sufficiently real world that you can see that happening to some people that you know, and having someone that's making use of their children in the world and possibly willing to sacrifice them actually pops up on a lot in mythology and literature. And it's kind of rooted in real stuff. It's not crazy. And it's kind of, you know, it's an interesting character gaining power in the world that's kind of scary to be on the other end of it. And that's a really interesting character, I think, that has stuck in my mind my whole life.
Hmm. And do you feel that you see this influence leaking into gaming at some point? Are there D&D modules or other content that you feel like I'm of course recognize that like this kind of fantasy literature is what was inspiring to gaming, but I'm just kind of curious, has this aspect shown up, or is it generally just completely disregarded?
I kind of think in my experience with classic D&D, this particular theme probably hasn't been explored. And the thing I was going to talk about later, the even more obvious thing is the outrageously monstrous mothers that are just flat out, you know, supernatural horrors of some sort. But this theme that I do think pops up in literature a bunch, I think hasn't been explored, and I think is a real rich vein of mixed motivations of you know, a woman in the world who's trying to get temporal power in smart, cunning, clever ways, and also has children that may possibly be, you know, maybe rewarded, like maybe the children are gifted with powers or magical weapons to their benefit, but also simultaneously being put at risk in the world at the behest of their mother. And I think that that's an interesting kind of mixed motivations that I don't think we've seen a lot in gaming or D&D in my experience. Let me throw out another example, right? Yeah. So the Irish mythology cycle, which features Cathulain as your primary character, he serves the king of Ulster, Concobar. And Concobar's primary opposition is Queen Maeve, the queen of Connaught. And so Queen Maeve is powerful, and she has riches, and she has lands and territories, and she has seven sons. And the whole Irish myth cycle is basically driven on Queen Maeve taunting her husband, saying, "I am clearly richer and a greater liege than you will ever be." And then in the argument, she determines to go to steal the greatest bull in the land. And that actually spawns the whole war that causes all of Cathulain's exploits. And so one thing that she did is she went to, in seeking to overthrow her opponent, King Concobar, she went to a druid and she asked, "Which of my seven sons can kill Concobar?" And the druid responded, "It is Mane." And none of Maeve's sons had that name. So in response, what she did is she renamed all of the Mane to make really sure to cover all of her bases that one of her kids had the capacity to kill her opponent. And so from then on, her sons were simply known as the Seven Mane. and they would appear on the battlefield all together. And she was willing to change, to sacrifice the identities of all seven of her children in her pursuit of conquest.
And that sounds like such a thing that a player in a D&D game would come up with, right? Like, that's I've been given this information that is confusing, right? You didn't name any of my children. Ah, I found the loophole. I'm going to name them all that.
Right? Just in case the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 didn't do it, I've got more coming where that, I've got more where that came from. Right?
That's amazing.
That's like really committed.
That is hilarious.
And of course, Jerry is pointing out in the chat there, the thing that would come to many of our minds is Grendel's mother in Beowulf. So Beowulf, of course, makes the hideous monster Grendel and then turns around and then has to deal with the even more challenging result of Grendel's mother attempting her best to kill Beowulf. And it's a really interesting point that is actually still up for debate among Beowulf scholars. And there's a couple of really critical words, just really critical words in the original Beowulf that people still debate what specifically they mean. And in particular, like, there's debate about whether there's really two chapters to Beowulf or there are three. Does Grendel's mother just count as part of the Grendel part of the story? Or is that like a second chapter all unto herself? And interestingly, there's a particular word that they use to describe her, and that word is Eglek, if I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right, but Eglek. And that word gets used for both Beowulf and Grendel's mother. And in most translations, when Eglek is used for Beowulf, it turns into like hero, right, or protagonist or something. And when that same word is used for Grendel's mother, it turns into witch, or wretch, or demon. And it's the same word. And so some people debate about, it was that, you know, is that biased? Is what's happening with Grendel's mother really like a vengeful demon? Or is she more like a Valkyrie taking, you know, the classic blood oath of I need to defend my family and take revenge for, you know, people being slain in my family? And is she is she equivalently an anti-hero type figure that's compelled by their traditions in order to try to, you know, take vengeance for their family? And that's still debated today about exactly how we should interpret the role of Grendel's mother. Could be a demon, could be a committed, you know, Valkyrie type hero trying to defend her family.
So how do we see this translated into the Monster Manual?
Okay, so among the very first things that I thought of, and it appears on a whole lot of D&D covers like that, is of course Tiamat, right? She's probably the most prominent D&D mother of all, and ruler of the first plane of hell in D&D, and has 5 heads, obviously, which represent all the different classic evil dragons, and is held out as the mother of all the evil dragons and all the monsters in D&D fundamentally. And of course, the name Tiamat comes from Mesopotamian mythology, where maybe a sea serpent, maybe the chaos of the sea itself that spawned all the deities and then in a war spawned all the monsters, was ultimately slain by Marduk, and then from her body was fashioned the entire cosmos and the world. So we all live in Tiamat, according to Mesopotamian religion, actually. And so, often held out as the final big boss of all in D&D, and really, you know, fills this role of the mother as, you know, potentially completely, you know, monstrous, and, you know, motherhood as, you know, possibly breeding monsters that you see in a lot of mythology. So that's kind of like way out on the far end of the continuum.
I find it fascinating.
Right?
You know, the funny thing is I'm very aware of Tiamat, but like prior to this show, I had never actually heard of Tiamat referred to as a mother. And I was just looking up for like where does that come from? Like, where is that written? Like, and is she just a mother, or is she specifically a mother of some other character or other creature or other thing? I'm not finding any. Is it just in her title? Because frankly, I'm finding the same. The first monster that came to my brain was Lolth. And I was like,
okay, yeah.
Lolth, right? She's a mother, right? Isn't she? But I can't think of, like, yes, she's just referred to as, you know, the Dark Queen Mother, but just in this, like, overarching sense of what we know of as being maternal to an entire society. Not so much, right. Like, I can't point and be like, Lolth specifically had these children. Like, these are the sons and daughters of Lolth. Maybe that comes up somewhere that I'm not aware of, but mostly I just see it splashed into the title.
Yeah, I think, right, it's pretty common for all those female deities to wind up with, like, mother in their title. Certainly Tiamat, like, in the first edition text, is very explicit. It says, Tiamat rules the first plane of the Nine Hells, where she spawns all of evil dragonkind.
All dragons are ultimately begotten of Tiamat.
All evil dragons, yes.
All evil dragons, right. But still, like... Right. Yeah, is that meant metaphorically or literally? That's what I'm trying to come up with. Like, is any evil dragon you come up to in theory say like, yeah, my mom's Tiamat?
Well, so I'm sure that this varies by what year you're talking about, or what edition, or what publication, or who's interpreting it. I think that when I first picked up that book and I read it, I assumed that it was literal. And I assume that she's at the top of the family tree. If she might be a particular dragon's mother or grandmother or great grandmother or great 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 grandmother, possibly. We know that, you know, dragons in D&D have eggs and they have children and they have family clutches. But my assumption was that she is, you know, she's the top of the family tree for all evil dragons.
So fascinating. It's not a thing that I've ever really bothered to sit down and think about, right? Because, okay, of course, we know that dragons are ancient, right? Like, we're used to this idea that dragons live for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. So how many generations of dragons exist? Right? That's the next question that comes into my brain.
Right.
I don't know the answer to that.
Now I want an answer to that. Now I actually want a campaign role that specifically answers. We are now in the 573rd generation of dragons since the world started. That should be part of somebody's, what do we call it now, lore.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting detail that could possibly be. And again, it comes directly out of, you know, Mesopotamian mythology, that a war of the deities started and Tiamat's response was, I'm going to start spawning monsters in order to fend off the good deities. And we also see that with, like in Norse mythology, Loki's wife, Angerboder, I believe was her name, also started spawning. I think she was like a normal looking goddess, but she started spawning horrible monsters, is something that we see quite a bit. And actually this particular theme of, a mythological deity of chaos that is from the sea, that's maybe a sea serpent, that is almost, to take a point from Campbell, is a point that gets, it shows up with Marduk fighting Tiamat, it shows up with Thor fighting Jormungand, it shows up with Yahweh defeating the Leviathan, Hada defeating Lotan. That's like a really common trait of some kind of like storm god fighting the world sea serpent. And so that is something that, again, I like working into my gaming, because it feels like it strikes some kind of really deep core in what it means to be a human on Earth for some reason. So I do kind of like reaching for those themes when I can.
It's such an interesting take, I think, of this idea that it's a very old world take, right? Of these creatures being established as mothers because they're, you know, creating offspring as mm-hmm. a means to an end, right? Because they're a mm-hmm. useful thing to have, right? It's like this old world idea of like, well, we had children because we needed someone to work the fields, right? Like, we need more people, and the best way to get more people is to just make them,
which, yeah, I feel right, like right.
this day and age. That doesn't really land so well with folks, right? Like, why did you have children? Like, most people will not answer because I needed more workers.
Well put. Well put. Yeah. And so this that idea of you know, it being, and again, this it's really hard, not me not being a psychologist, but it's real hard not to point to the writers of, you know, early, you know, of fantasy, 20th century fantasy literature and D&D in particular, as some of this, yes, talking about their psyches, about like among the most horrifying things that I can possibly imagine is a mother with power. That seems like possibly really destructive to my whole way of life. And that does, right? And that does pop up a number of times. And so in actual like D&D adventures that I can, like early D&D adventures, the original, you know, the first ever published D&D adventure cycle, which is the Against the Giants and Descent into the Depths, right, does ping that a couple times. Like the like Against the Giants is inspired by The Roaring Trumpet by DeCamp and Pratt, and among the really important plot points is that there's a troll jailer whose primary interest is at some point securing a troll wife, and they're off screen, and presumably they're supposedly much larger, they're more powerful than normal trolls, and that's an important plot point. And then you get to the shrine of the Koa-Toa, and they worship a lobster-headed female deity called Blibdulpoop, otherwise known as the Sea Mother. And that's like the penultimate horrible thing that you can possibly confront. And then the final most horrible thing, and you mentioned Lolth before, Paul, and the final most horrible thing that you can possibly confront at the end of the Descent of the Depths series is an entire culture that's matriarchal, right? So the dark elves, the drow, have a hidden underground city that's entirely controlled by a society of women high priests, and they control all the noble houses and all the communities, and they spin webs of sinister plots to take over the surface world. And that is what our friend Gary established as the single most horrible thing that he could come up with at the end of the adventure series for original D&D. And, you know, nowadays, and for what it's worth, I have an image there. So for nowadays,
I feel like Freud would have a lot of interesting questions to ask of Mr. Gygax.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And so now, in this idea that all the noble houses of the drow are run by, you know, powerful women figures, and what fifth edition likes to do is they like to formalize those types of figures. And so now one of those characters that runs one of the drow noble houses is formally known as a matron mother. And fifth edition has a particular standard stat block for the matron mothers that run the drow society. And I will now say that that's one of the things that, like on D&D Beyond, is marked with a legacy warning flag, right? This you might consider about whether this is appropriate your table or not, because it might have some built-in notes or themes that maybe not everybody wants to see at their table.
That's interesting.
And that's the kind of thing that probably Mother gets connected to a lot in classic D&D, interestingly.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's like I feel personally, I always took it as the reason you see so many like monstrous mothers, and I never really bothered to sit down and trace a lot of the mythological roots that you're talking about here, which is of course very interesting. But if just like if you go back to just wild animals, right? If you just think about wild animals, right? There's certainly like a lot of conventional wisdom of like, yeah, don't rile a mother bear, right? You see a bear with cubs, get the hell out of there, right? Because the expectation is, oh, here's a creature that is dangerous to you, but if it's protecting its young, it is much more dangerous to you, right? And I feel like you see that translated into D&D monsters a lot.
You do. You do. You know what? Pull up. You know, I pulled up, that's been in the text since the start of original D&D. So I have an image of, like, the one rule text that I pulled out of. Mm-hmm. And so this was first published, again, 50 years ago this year. And so I just looked at one page, has a couple of places where this shows up. And the very end of the dragons entry says, if two dragons are encountered, they're a mated pair. If three or four dragons are encountered, then they're a family group of a male, a female, and one or two young. If the young are attacked, then both parents will automatically use their breath weapons. And if the female is attacked, the male attacks at double value, unless he's simultaneously attacked, and vice versa. So both the father and the mother dragon of family can both attack, quote, apparently become double power if their mate is attacked. And then more specifically under lycanthropes, and you were talking about the idea that, you know, bear cubs and things like that will respond like that. And under lycanthropes, it says a family pack will consist of two adults and the balance of young of varying ages. If the young are attacked, the female adult will fight at triple value for four melee rounds. And there's no comment about what the father does. Apparently the father isn't so helpful, but it's specifically the female that gets triple power for a, you know, maybe werebears or werewolves or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so that that idea is baked directly into a rather potent superpower for the mother monsters in these types of situations, which I don't mind, frankly.
I recall that. So I was trying to think back of like D&D adventures where you counter maternal characters or monsters or whatnot. And the thing I kept thinking of, and this is ingrained in my head just because of the way you ran this, was playing the G series. And is it G3 is the Fire Giants? Is that right?
Yes.
I think right. So. And the time we sat down and played that, we just got absolutely hammered. Just, our poor group just did not fare well at all. And I remember making a second foray into the space and coming across a group of female fire giants. And I'm very curious how this is written in the module. I never went back to like look at it and read it myself. But their tactic that they used against us was they had big sacks and they were trying to scoop us up in the sack and then just bash us against the wall. And it was really horrific.
Yes. That for what it's worth, the module says to be creative, says mm-hmm. that you know, the giants are getting excellent genius advice, which turns out to be the matriarchal high priests of the drow. And mm-hmm. I think in the original tournament, I think the characters were all invisible, and those same matrons came out of the kitchen and threw bags of flour at the player mm-hmm. characters there in order to track them when they were invisible. So I think it was in the back of my mind that the women in the kitchen are creative enough with the stuff in the kitchen, they can come out and be a real monster.
Yep. And it was I mean, there's just something about that. Like, for some reason, that is more horrific to me than a group of fire giants coming at me with like axes and swords. Like, no, they have sacks and they're going to scoop you up in the sack and then just wail you against the wall. But it's interesting, right? Because it is a reasonable representation of how a creature, you know, again, you take the setting into account. They're working in a kitchen and some pests come in. Right?
Right.
See a rat sneak into your kitchen, grab that sack.
Right?
Seems a pretty reasonable way of dealing with these strange tiny pests right. that have invaded the kitchen.
Quick, I'm really glad that made a big impact. I'm so glad that made a big impact that you remember it to this day. I was pretty, because I think that I personally had to step up from the table, walk away, and then think in the kitchen for a while about some kind of creative thing to do, and then come back in. that was like an ad lib thing that I came up with on the fly. I'm really glad that made a big impact.
that is delightful.
Yeah. You know, let me throw out one other mother monster. And you know, I was at some point I got an opportunity to talk to Harold Johnson, who mm-hmm. is one of the authors of the classic module Hidden Shrine of Tamawakan. And in that module, there's, to me, one of the most terrifying monsters of all time for D&D, the monster that we know as the Gibbering Mouther, which is a Lovecraftian, you know, just a blob of eyes and mouths, just a hideous, monstrous blob of giant eyes and mouths that could seep over you, consume you, eat you, and also like has like a keening moan to confuse you so you can't get away or something like that. And interestingly, in the as Harold pointed out, in the, you know, super memorable, I hate that monster. I have never used it. It's such a terrifying monster. I don't even want to describe it to my players, right? And as Harold pointed out, in the earliest draft of that adventure, the monster wasn't the Gibbering Mouther. It was originally the Gibbering Mother.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Right? I'll tell you, that monster appears as one of the two most horrific monsters in Fearful Ends. Okay. There you go. Although I've retooled it a little bit to be called the Gibbering Mass of Orifices.
Yep. Yes. Right. I remember that in the monster's appendix. Right. I remember that. Yep. And I was like, oh crap, Paul had to include this. I'm glad I'm at the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, that said, actually, now that I think about it, I don't think that any of my scenarios I've written feature it. So that's, I'm going to have to do that. Now I feel challenged, Dan. I'm going to have to write a Gibbering Mass of Orifices into a scenario. Oh, and knowing its origin as it used to be a Gibbering Mother instead of Mouther,
yes.
Well, then I think it better be spewing out issue. It should be issuing forth smaller versions of itself. That's delightful. Yeah. And now I'm horrified because, of course, in my own version, I didn't mention mouths and I just said orifices. So, of course, I'm going to have all manner of orifices.
There you go. And of course, if you really want to ramp it up, right, the original D&Ds and Demigods, right? And literally the art by Errol Otis in the Cthulhu section of the D&Ds is so terrible that as a kid, I trained myself where it was so I could avoid it and never physically touch the pages. That's how much it terrified me. And I think the Gibbering Mouther / Mother is, you know, partly inspired by what they indicate as the deity Shub-Niggurath, or the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young, and which it takes up an entire cavern and constantly spews out monsters at the bottom of the world's deepest dungeon. So bringing a little bit of that with the what I'm going to call the Gibbering Mother for today. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. The single most terrifying monster in all of D&D for my entire life. If you want to bring that in, I apologize to everybody who has to suffer from that. So there you go.
That is delightful. Dan, we are just about out of time here. Do you have any final thoughts on mothers in D&D?
You know, there's a bunch of stuff we talked about today that I'm really glad we had the opportunity that you know, having celebrating Mother's Day allowed us to think about this. And there's a lot of fresh veins that I think that we could pursue that we haven't explored very much in our D&D gaming. And having player characters at the table that are children, you know, mothers and children, I think is something we haven't done enough. And I think that, you know, we've seen the monstrous mother types in D&D a bunch, but I think that this literary trope of a really driven mother who's seeking temporal power and is both gifting their children with power, but also putting them at risk is, I think, something that we haven't seen enough. So I think I'm going to try to work more of that into my gaming. And I think that's a very interesting, you know, how do you deal with these with this mixed bag of motivations, which makes for characters with a lot of depth.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely would love to see you know, as much as the content is focused on mothers as a in the monstrous category, I would love to see more NPCs that are monsters or monsters, NPCs that are mothers. NPCs that are mothers, or mothers that are mothers role play, a mother child relationship role play at the table amongst the group. I think that would be super fun.
Yeah. Super. A lot of stuff that I hadn't thought about before, honestly.
Viewers, if you have any thoughts of cases of mother portrayal in D&D Adventures or other RPG content that we haven't thought of, please let us know here in the comments of the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe you'll give us a nice example that we haven't thought of that we can include in a future conversation.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, by the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there. And please deface that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those third-party sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the show, every tier gets you access to a private Discord server. And among our favorite parts of the week, we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the chat with our live after chat with all of our patrons there. So we would love to see you there after you go to patreon.com/wanderingdms. So other things coming up on Wandering DMs channel this week. I'll be back Thursday night with more of Dan's Old Time Mini Show. And the other thing, we love to hype people, that friends that we've had on the channel here in the past. So I will also point out that my adversary in the first two seasons of Book of War here, Isabel Garbani, is currently starring in a play in New York called Apostrophe at the American Theater of the Actors, which is just off Times Square. And it's a sufficient hit that she's starring in that it has been extended for another week. So you can still get tickets this upcoming extended week there to Apostrophe. And I will say, I'm as neutral as I can, I saw it last week. It is excellent. It's great. So if you are around New York, it might possibly make for a great late Mother's Day gift if you didn't think to get your mother anything. You can go online right today and get online tickets and present that as a gift today to Apostrophe.
Amazing. Definitely. Please go check it out. I'm sure it's a fantastic show. If I was closer myself, I would be there immediately.
It is actually very, very good. So if you are in the area, I would actually recommend that this extended week here. So don't forget, we, Wandering DMs, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.